Hi, I'm Frank Ferris, one of the principals of the Palliative Care Interdisciplinary Curriculum. I want to personally thank you for joining us for this module in our series on complex illness.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Chris Ritz. I'm one of the attendings over at Ohio State, and I'm going to be talking to you guys today about palliative care emergencies, or sometimes they're actually urgencies, but it's kind of a list of a few things that you might run into and just some strategies to deal with those. So, as there's going to be a couple different things to cover, my objectives are a little strange, but basically we're going to talk about them, obviously, and then my other two objectives would be to list a common symptom with each to kind of give you a clue if it's presenting to you, what to think of, and then also maybe a treatment pearl or two, just so that, you know, if you remember those and something's happening, you have a place to start, you can get going, and then kind of go from there. So. Okay, so we'll start with a case. 54-year-old male, has a history of hypertension, chronic lower back pain, and then prostate cancer, diagnosed about a year ago. He comes to you, he has about 9 weeks of progressively worsening thoracic back pain, weakness in his lower extremities, and a little bit of trouble walking. So, what are you guys thinking? Yes, yes, okay. Anything else you need to know from this case, or is that pretty? Okay, these are more illustrative, so they'll probably be pretty easy. So, so this is going to be spinal cord compression. And here's a graphic of kind of what's going on. Basically, it's metastatic disease that's going to be pushing out into the spinal cord. And basically, really what it is it's physical compression. Again, it's metastatic disease. It's pushing into the epidural space. And really, what actually ends up happening is it compresses the epidural venous plexus, causes vasogenic edema, which ultimately ends up causing ischemia in the cord. There's other ways that this can happen, either through leptomeningeal spread or even actual intramedullary on the actual spinal cord, but those are much less common. Usually it's up to the vertebrae. So in my case, I use thoracic because that's really the most common. It's about 70% of those will be thoracic, but you can see them in the lumbar and cervical spine as well. And about a third of them are going to be in multiple levels too, so you need to be aware of that. But the thoracic makes it a little bit easier to kind of, it gives you another clue, because a lot of times it's usually more neck pain or lower back pain that you see with more benign, you know, osteoarthritis or degenerative disc disease. So new thoracic back pain, and then ultimately if weakness in someone who has cancer, especially metastatic, you want to think of that. So almost everyone is going to present with pain. It's not 100%, but that's going to be really how you find it. And generally, it's just pain. And then about 8 to 12 weeks in is when you start to see some of these other symptoms that are going to really kind of nail in the diagnosis. It's going to be localized initially. It can spread as it gets worse. And one of the other clues you can see is if they're lying down, it can get worse. That has to do with the venous congestion. And then again, later on in the presentation, you're going to see weakness. And even later, you're going to see things like sensory loss and loss of bowel and bladder. And that usually means it's pretty late. So ideally, you would want to catch this a little bit earlier. So to diagnose this, first you want to check strength and reflexes, do a good neuro exam to kind of see if you can get any clues. Again, if it's really late and they're talking about, like saddle anesthesia or things like that, you obviously would want to check rectal tone, things like that. To get the diagnosis, the gold standard is going to be an MRI. It should be through the whole spine again, because it's going to be in multiple areas oftentimes. If they can't get an MRI for whatever reason, renal failure or something of that sort, a pacemaker or something like that, you can get a CT myelogram, which should give you a good visualization of the spine, and you can see if there's anything pushing in on it. Some of the most common cancers to have that in are breast cancer, lung cancer, and prostate cancer, hence or gentlemen with prostate cancer. But also renal cancer, lymphoma, and myeloma can cause this too, a little less common. So the initial management, if you're thinking compression, you should give them steroids, usually 8 milligrams as soon as you suspect it, IV of dexamethasone, and then you want to do the standard 4 milligrams Q6 hours scheduled. You obviously, of course, and you guys, I'm sure, have had lots of practice with this already, you want to manage their pain. A lot of times it's going to be very painful and require opioids. And then as soon as you know, you want to manage promptly, because especially when you get to the point with sensory loss or weakness, that's, you know, there's a pretty small window of that onset and then actually having permanent sequela from that. So once you give them steroids, then you got to kind of look into what their prognosis is and see if you want to do either, you know, radiotherapy or surgical, or simply radiotherapy, or both radiotherapy and surgical decompression. Prognosis is also going to tell you if you're going to do a short, you know, a couple of fractions of radiotherapy or a long course. And then surgical decompression, if they're stable enough to get surgery, that's been found to actually have better outcomes in pretty much all the issues you would have with it. So prognosis, symptoms, and then functional status. Even with all of this, though, it's usually a bad sign when somebody has a spinal cord compression from metastatic disease, and you're looking at a prognosis of around 5 months. Some other clues with that, obviously, are going to be functional status and the type of cancer that they have. So, any questions about spinal cord compression? No? Okay. Second case is an 89-year-old female. She has metastatic breast cancer. She had a lump for a while, didn't look into it, ended up presenting with an ulcerative lesion. Her and her family had decided to just manage with comfort. So she went home with hospice care. And then you get a call from the hospice nurse, and they're saying, well, this ulcerative lesion is starting to bleed pretty briskly. The patient and the daughter are really anxious. What should we do? So that's an ulcerative lesion from metastatic breast cancer. So obviously this is hemorrhage. I'm looking at, that's pretty straightforward. There's not really a big differential for that. So there can be a lot of different etiologies from bleeding, GI hemoptysis, vaginal bleeding, the fungating skin lesion that I talked about, hematuria, or just clotting failure. Generally, people who are really sick obviously can have trouble clotting for various reasons. And then some of these can actually be terminal. Terminal hemorrhages are more close to big arteries, like the carotid artery, are things to worry about. So if those start to bleed, those are really hard to manage, and usually that's not something you can really do a lot about. So in the history, it's important to know where the cancer location is. If it's close to a major artery, that's when you're going to think that there's more of a risk of bleeding. In the bronchus, if there's lesions there, that can lead to hemoptysis. Again, you want to check for coagulopathy issues. Things like DIC or liver failure can contribute to this. And then understand how fast the bleed is, because that may change how you manage this. And you're going to see this. There is bleeding, maybe in 6 to 14% of advanced cancer. Not all of that ends up being a terminal bleed. It's usually something else usually it could be controlled. So probably the most important thing in management, especially if you identified somebody with risk to bleed like this, you want to have a clear plan. So are they going to, what happens when they bleed? What happens when they have a GI bleed? Do you want to go to the hospital for resuscitative measures, or do you want to try to stay at home? And that's obviously going to depend on prognosis and patient preference. But having that kind of set up will give you, in that urgent setting, kind of help you figure out what to do. So some simple things you would want to start to do, if possible, you want to put pressure. If it's, a skin lesion, if it's in a cavity, you want to do packing. Tranexamic acid or epinephrine soaked pads can sometimes help. Sometimes you'll see in patients with GI bleeds or other issues, they'll actually use radiotherapy or sometimes embolization as well to actually stop the blood supply to where it's bleeding in patients who are more in a resuscitative mode. If that fails, you can use systemic medications to help stop the bleeding. Again, tranexamic acid can be given, and aminocaproic acid as well. Those are generally not a lot of side effects, but you do need to watch if they have a urinary tract bleed. If you cause a clot, then you could cause obstruction and cause renal failure and other issues. So maybe something to think about if they're having hematuria and it's really bad. So some other specific issues, so carotid blowout, I don't know if anyone's seen this. They've probably at least seen somebody carotid blowout, caution. So obviously that can be pretty quick as far as a lot of blood loss quickly. So if you want to, so you can sometimes, depending on prognosis, you can do an endovascular intervention with risks of stroke undergoing that procedure. And then also people with lung and bronchial issues, you can have massive hemoptysis. A couple of different ways to manage that. You can intubate or do bronchoscopy to try to stop the bleeding. You can embolize the bronchial artery, or you can actually put a stent in the bronchus. So. Upper GI bleed, things like varices, you can use octreotide or vasopressin, and then depending on the goals, again, you can send them to endoscopy and try to manage the variceal bleeds or the ulcerative bleeds or whatever the patient's having issues with. If it is a terminal bleed, really it's kind of just controlling the situation and making it as comfortable and least anxiety provoking as possible. So they always say have dark towels available if you can find them. So it's not usually blood on white towels is kind of a stressful thing for anyone to see, or gauze. So generally you're going to have to sedate these patients because there's not a lot to do and they're going to die pretty quickly. So something like midazolam, 10 milligrams, just to kind of put them to sleep. And minimize any distress they're going to have, or the family members or friends are going to have witnessing this. And then it's been found staying with them too can be really helpful. So it may be obvious to some, but just you don't want to leave the room. Just stay there, kind of, so they know that there's safety there. There's something that we can do, or at least control the situation while it's happening. Okay, questions about that? Has anyone seen a terminal bleed like that? Yeah, it doesn't happen very often, so you always probably have heard about it as far as concerns, but generally, it's not too common. So,
in anticipated cases, we're actually sending a lot of patients home with intranasal midazolam.
Okay,
To try and mitigate, because they don't have access, or you're going to get access quickly enough with intranasal, you're there.
Yes, yeah, so that's a good point. So so they were saying that the having intranasal midazolam is one option for patients who are going to go home, because especially if it's just the patient and the family, we may not be able to get out there in time. So giving instructions so that they can be quickly sedated if that's an issue while somebody's out to kind of help the family can be, it's a really good idea. So any other thoughts, questions? All right, third case. So this is a 67-year-old male with small cell lung cancer. He's presenting to us with swelling of the face and the neck. He's coughing and he's hoarse. What are you thinking?
SVC.
Superior vena cava syndrome, yes. So this is a picture. This guy doesn't look as sick as probably someone we would see with the superior vena cava syndrome, but you can see kind of some of the, and I don't know if it's projecting very well, but you can see some of the veins, the collateral veins kind of engorged. This will be one of the signs that you'll see. So obviously this is an obstruction of the superior vena cava, causes increased venous pressure and shunting to the collateral veins. It's going to be either from pressure on the superior vena cava through a tumor, a lymph node, or through a thrombus actually in the vena cava. So so again, you're going to see the collaterals dilate. It does have a transient effect on cardiac output, even if it's a quick onset, like let's say there's a big thrombus that you throw and you stop. It might be a couple of hours, but generally we found it's not significant. Most people are going to be actually pretty stable even if this happens very quickly. So it kind of puts it more into the urgency category. Some of the signs you can see are shortness of breath, cough, dysphagia, hoarseness, and head and neck edema, like our patient that we just talked about. Some of the more severe symptoms, you can see headache, blurred vision, altered mental status, and even seizures from this. To diagnose it, the gold standard is superior vena cavography, which is basically looking in with dye to see. But oftentimes you'll end up getting a contrast enhanced CT because that's going to give us a lot more information about the tissues around the vein, and generally can show us if there's a mass occluding it or something of that sort. So sometimes that might be at least something to add on or may be sufficient for diagnosis. So management, again, it's uncommon for it to be to have somebody present with unstable superior vena cava syndrome. You're going to see things like stridor or hemodynamic instability is when you're going to really start to worry, in which case, honestly, they're probably, they would hopefully have to go to the emergency department if they're going to get intubated, depending on what the goals are, to do, either emergent radiotherapy or a stent to try to stabilize that. But for the most part, these people are going to present to you with some of those more mild symptoms. And then it's really, trying over the next couple of weeks to shrink that tumor. And oftentimes that's going to be chemotherapy, which generally these tumors will have good response to that. It just takes a couple of weeks, 1 to 2 weeks probably. And then depending on where you're at in the course of the disease, if you need to get a biopsy, if this person's presenting to you with just superior vena cava syndrome, you should get the biopsy before you give them radiation therapy. And then, again, because usually it's not an emergency, you can wait for that. And that'll help with chemotherapy and kind of giving a better plan for treatment. Another more simple thing is keep the head of the bed up, because a lot of times these patients get really congested because they don't have as good a venous return. So trying to help with that some. And then if it's from a lymphoma, steroids can help with this too. This one, so depending on which type of primary cancer causes this, it can either be a bad prognosis, or if you see small cell lung cancer, it's actually paradoxically a little bit better of a prognosis if you find this. Usually if it's going to be a little more responsive to chemotherapy. Questions?
In any of those kind of cancers in which we have giving steroids for anti-inflammatory properties, if they have an underlying anxiety problem, then we're a bit skeptic about starting steroids. I know benefits should outweigh the risk, but sometimes they're just so anxious that they are not happy with steroids. Anything else you can recommend?
I guess I would, in that case, I would look at it. I mean, if it really is a lymphoma and there's a good reason to give the steroids to help with those symptoms, I would try to manage their anxiety symptoms, through either an antipsychotic or a benzodiazepine if it was really going to be helpful. If it was one of the other, like a small cell or something like that, then I probably would just kind of, I would just kind of proceed with radiotherapy or and chemotherapy and not, obviously not given the side effects, there's going to not be a lot of benefit. So, make sense? Okay. All right, case four. So this is a 37-year-old male. He has melanoma that's metastatic to his brain. He's, I have a spelling error. He's an inpatient hospice for altered mental status. The wife calls to the nursing station saying that he's unresponsive and shaking. So what are you guys thinking? Seizure. And there's a hemorrhagic lesion in the brain. That's probably what's going on with the metastatic melanoma to the brain. So when you're thinking about seizures, there's a pretty broad differential for these things. A structural is one, so a hemorrhagic stroke, increasing mass, infection can all cause that. Drugs themselves can cause seizures, obviously, and also drug withdrawal. Brain radiation, some of the edema and swelling after that can cause structural changes as well that can induce a seizure, and then metabolic abnormalities. So with this kind of broad differential, you need to, if you can, depending again on the goals, you want to do try to work them up a little bit at least. Get blood work, check if it's for hypoglycemia, check the electrolytes. A head CT can be really helpful, especially if you're not previously the patient didn't have structural issues in the head, that can kind of give you a clue. And then if you're really thinking it's more of an infectious etiology, you'd want to check a lumbar puncture, which, and that could also tell you if there's metastatic disease into the CNS. So in the patients, so you guys probably have dealt with this already in your hospice rotations. You want to try to, if they've already had seizures, then you want to try to prevent it. It kind of gives you a little bit more of a heads up. So continue the therapy the best they can. I've provided a list here of some of the anti-seizure medications that if you can't give them by mouth, you can give them rectally. So a lot of these are actually one-to-one, like phenobarbital, carbamazepine, valproic acid, and lamotrigine, and then levetiracetam is actually 2-to-1. So that's kind of an option. I know that's something I struggle with a little bit. And sometimes, you know, you only have so much as far as what's available in your pharmacy too. So my approach has generally been, if you can do these things, go for it. If you can't, then you kind of go to the more abortive measures if something happens. And again, especially if they're really close to death, then, you know, obviously they're probably not going to be awake, so giving them benzodiazepines to sedate them is a good, you know, a good strategy. And being ready for that too, because obviously that can be really distressing to the family. So benzodiazepines like lorazepam are going to be kind of your first line go-to. You can try about 2 milligrams and give that up to every 2 minutes. And then you want to go up to about 8 milligrams. After 8 milligrams, you're going to start to see respiratory depression. So if you haven't gotten taken care of the seizure by then, you might have to go to a different medication. So there's fosphenytoin or phenytoin can be used. The only issues there, especially in more of a comfort care hospice setting, it depends on your goals, but there should be cardiac monitoring. You can get arrhythmias from that. So if they're in the ED, they can get that, obviously. If they're having a seizure and their prognosis is maybe a couple of weeks or a couple of months, you may be a little more hesitant with that. But obviously if they're, you know, within days or hours, then can also be considered. And then if those don't work, a barbiturate like phenobarbital would work as well. And the dosing for that's very similar to how you would palliative sedate somebody as well. You would want to give 30 to 120 milligrams and see if that would hold the seizure. And that's going to have the advantage of lasting for about 6 or 8 hours too. So, okay, questions about seizures? Have you guys had any experiences with seizures in inpatient hospice? Okay. Care to share?
We just had a patient with a history of epilepsy that was dying from other causes, who was no longer taking oral medications, mm-hmm. and was on 3 different anti-seizure medications. Mm-hmm. And so at the point that he was no longer taking oral, we were looking at hours to days for his timeline. And so we ended up just scheduling Ativan on him, mm-hmm. to Q6. And, you know, I talked to the pharmacist about that. Is there a certain amount that you would schedule? And she said there really isn't a standard for scheduling Ativan. But mm-hmm. we didn't even think about the rectal administration of medication. So I thought that was helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's something in practice I haven't done a whole lot of either. It's generally if they're awake and we can get their meds, we keep them going. And then otherwise, I'm trying to think in the past when I was having these patients that came in with a history of seizures, I would sometimes just do Ativan as needed. And I guess that would have to depend on if you were really worried scheduling them, especially if they're not awake, right? If, you know, it's not going to hurt as far as them being a little sedated, and then it's going to be a little bit better for the family. So
also, that's another scenario where we can use the intranasal Versed. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So any benzodiazepine would work too. So, yeah. And then again, and I had put, you know, you can do it intramuscularly and subcutaneously, but yeah, there's a lot of different ways to administer that. So, okay. Fifth case, last case. This is a 65-year-old female. This is maybe slightly more tricky, but maybe not for people who are palliative trained. So, 65-year-old female with metastatic ovarian cancer. She presents with diffuse weakness, confusion, and polyuria for the last couple of days. She calls her clinic. They say, well, you're taking too much morphine. I want you to cut your morphine in half. The husband calls again, and a day later, there's no improvement. She's still really confused, and her pain's worse now. Hypercalcemia, yeah. So, and that's the best picture I could come up with for it's hard to kind of visualize that, right? So the pathophysiology. So basically, this is due to bone resorption or osteolysis, depending on what type of cancer is causing this hypercalcemia. A lot of times, it's humoral in breast cancer, lung cancer, and renal cancer. It's parathyroid hormone issues. If it's lymphoma, there's actually increased calcitriol. And then, in less commonly, but with if you see somebody with multiple myeloma, you actually worry about osteolysis too. So when you're getting a history, so you may see people with hypercalcemia technically on labs that aren't having any symptoms, and that's generally mild, obviously. Moderate, you can start to see some of these symptoms that our patient had, like polyuria and polydipsia, maybe nausea and constipation. If it's severe, that's when you start to see weakness, confusion, coma. So really to diagnose this, you'd want to get blood work, and I've put the values in here. So mild, again, is less than 12. I think to be actually considered on a lab, it's like 10 or 10 and a half. And then the other thing you might see is millimoles per liter, so less than 3. Moderate's in between, obviously, and then severe is greater than 14 or greater than 3.5 millimoles per liter. Management. With mild cases, you just want to give hydration. You want to try to advise them to not be inactive for a while, because that can actually promote bone resorption and increase their calcium. And then if they are on thiazide diuretics, consider stopping those, because that's going to increase calcium reabsorption as well. If you get a moderate value back on your lab, you want to look at the patient and see where they're at. If their symptoms are still kind of more on the mild side, then you just do the same things. If they're starting to get worse and they're having cognitive issues, then you would want to jump over to management for severe, which is going to be isotonic saline, zoledronic acid, or pimidronate, which are the bisphosphonates, and there's some dosing on here for those. And those will take about 2 to 4 days to drop the calcium level. Some other options you can do are provide calcitonin or denosumab in refractory symptoms. These are sometimes good options in patients with renal issues as well. And then again, with lymphoma, you can give them steroids too, which might help. So, questions about hypercalcemia? All right, so finally to objective 2. So this is just kind of a list so we can review things. So, back pain, and if you're seeing weakness because it's late, think of spinal cord compression, especially if it's in the thoracic region. Hemorrhage is going to be easy to see because it's visible, but if you, get to patients, you always want to be thinking in the back of your head, is there any, especially if it's a head and neck cancer or something that's going to be close to an artery, or there's actual skin lesions, you want to make sure you think about hemorrhage. If you're seeing neck or facial edema, think of superior vena cava syndrome. Obviously, tonic-clonic movements, that's seizures. And then weakness or confusion, you want to worry about malignant hypercalcemia. And then some just very quick treatment pearls. So the spinal cord compression, if you think it, give them steroids, and then look into what kind of tumor intervention you can do. If it's a hemorrhage, if it's brisk, kind of the quick things you want to do are get ready to sedate them and get some towels to minimize the distress. Superior vena cava syndrome, generally you want to get them to radiation. Again, that's most often more of an urgent thing, so you might want to take a step back and decide how you're going to proceed with that treatment. Seizures, you want to use benzodiazepines as abortive measures. Malignant hypercalcemia, use a bisphosphonate. So, And since I have five different topics, my summary is very broad. It's a, you know, you always want to anticipate and prepare for these common emergencies, and then make sure you have your clear goals, like we always do, so that we know how to, you know, we know if we want to keep them, try to keep them at home, or ship them off to the emergency department to try to handle these issues. So, okay. Any other thoughts or questions? All right. Thank you.
Thanks again for tuning in. I hope you'll rate and review this podcast and share it with your colleagues and your friends. So you don't miss any of our new content, make sure you are subscribing to PCIC Podcasts. PCIC is sponsored by PalMed, where our aim is to advance palliative care globally and ensure all clinicians have the latest knowledge and skill. To access more PCIC content, please visit palmed.us to review our extensive open access PCIC curriculum.